listening to the Tennis.com podcast. And here's your host, Ed McGrogan.
Hello, friends. This is once again the Tennis.com podcast with Ed McGrogan and Steve Tigner, a Tuesday at noon. And time to really dig into February tennis and all that comes with it. And it starts off this month with, following the Australian Open, went into a Fed Cup week. I think somewhat of an interesting one, especially because Angelique Kerber, the Aussie Open champ, plays immediately. But, the bigger takeaway after looking at all the results, Steve, to me was, maybe a couple of years ago in Davis Cup when Switzerland, when they had Federer and Wawrinka sign on, Federer in particular, that made them, kind of think bigger about the competition. And I'm sort of thinking that maybe that's the case with Switzerland now on the women's side, when you've got Martina Hingis and Belinda Bencic, and a pretty strong team up and down, winning and getting a home tie in their semifinal. So I thought that was the most interesting match of the weekend.
Yeah, I think it was, first we saw, it was interesting because Angelique Kerber came back to Germany after winning the Australian Open for the first time. There was a big crowd, an enthusiastic crowd, and they seemed like they were ready to win that tie. But then we saw Belinda Bencic come through with three wins, and Martina Hingis, sort of the secret weapon at the end, win in doubles. I think the coach Heinz Gunhardt said afterwards that he wasn't sure how far they could go. I think maybe he wasn't even considering that they could win that tie or move ahead. But you have to feel like they can now. I think one thing this weekend did was kind of get a couple of the young players on track again. Bencic had a pretty good Australian Open, but now we really saw her in a pressure situation, playing for her country, really come through. And also in the tie with Spain, Garbine Muguruza obviously had a terrible Australian Open, did the same thing. She won a couple matches. You sort of feel like Fed Cup can do that for a player, can kind of put them in a completely different atmosphere, get them out of themselves, maybe help turn them around a little bit. And I guess we saw Kerber, Kerber's not going to win every match she plays. She came out and won her first match.
Convincingly, 1-3 over Baczynski, yep.
Yeah, she looked good there, but then kind of ran out of gas against Bencic, so we see the sort of continued kind of back and forth rise of Bencic and really Martina Hingis. We haven't talked much about her, but this was really a showcase for her as well to come out at 35. She and her regular partner Sonia Mirza have won three straight Grand Slams. They're going to go for their own Grand Slam at the French Open this year. Pretty amazing, kind of under the radar.
Yeah, with Martina, are we kind of underappreciating really all of this at her age and with what she's kind of rededicated to this portion of her career?
I think so. I mean, it does also show, I guess, that people like Federer and Serena, who are 34, 35, same age as she is, and still at the top of the singles game, it almost makes you appreciate them a little more. Hingis is doing this in doubles. But I guess she hasn't gotten, she just hasn't gotten the attention. And I think it's pretty unexpected. She's retired twice, is already in the Tennis Hall of Fame, doesn't show that much in singles, but still has, still has the skills, the instincts, a sort of old-fashioned game that's good for doubles. And she's partnered with a more powerful player in Mirza, who was a good singles player. So, they make a good combination. I think it just shows that Hingis is just natural ability. It really never goes away, never goes out of style. She can still use it, still do things that kind of younger players can't do. And Bencic said that Hingis did all the double stuff, quote unquote, the double stuff, and did all the volley and all the sort of stuff that a lot of younger players like her don't really learn anymore. So in that sense, it's great to watch Hingis.
Yeah, and I think also perhaps part of it is that she has been away from the game for a couple extended periods that, truthfully, she doesn't have the mileage that many other players are going to have. Doubles is a different, an easier format anyway on the body, and you know, it's easy for me to kind of see her really playing perhaps into her 40s if she wants to. It seems like she does have, you know, especially compared to her earlier career when, you know, she was, and deservedly so, you know, looked at as this, you know, as the world's great player, you know, sort of prodigious upbringing. And, you know, just the glare of the spotlight was just so harsh at times, none more so than against Graf at Roland Garros. But it seems like she does have sort of a renewed appreciation for the game. I remember, I mean, recently she was, I think before she got back into doubles, she was doing TV work for the game. It just seemed like she was kind of embracing this lifestyle a little bit more. And, you know, with her, this could be a particularly fruitful year, not just in Fed Cup, because it's the, you know, it's the Olympics, and, you know, she'll be catapulted into, you know, an even greater spotlight depending on what she wants to do with next. I think the word, what, you know, she is playing with Federer, you know, she'll probably play with, you know, make sense to play with Bencic too in that. So this, you know, this could be kind of a, almost in a way, like a career year of sorts for her.
Yeah, and I think you're right that she could play for a long time. If you look at the male doubles players, Daniel Nestor, he was just in the Australian Open final. He's over 40. Ingis could play as long as she wants, you know, as long as, you know, if she still needs to play, if she still feels, you know, that desire. I think she, you know, she retired from singles originally at 22. I think there's still a sense of an unfinished career. She was kind of driven out of the game much earlier than she would have liked, both injuries and just the way the game changed to a more powerful singles game. But maybe this is a chance for her to kind of feel like I've done everything I could.
Right. Yeah. And looking back at a Germany-Swiss tie, Kerber ended up playing the second and third rubber. So she actually played two matches back-to-back days, not even a match in between there. So there's that element of it, too. And, you know, doubles gets the last. They get the fifth rubber. You don't even often see doubles in Fed Cup ties, but, it came down to it here. Swiss play the Czechs next at home. Czech Republic beat Romania. The other semi will be France against the Netherlands, Italy and Russia losing in the first round, and the U.S. will go from one tropical climate, in Hawaii, they'll go to actually Australia to play their way back into the World Group for the 2017 competition. Oddly enough, that's where the U.S. Davis Cup team will be playing, too. They'll be playing in Australia, so both of the American teams end up going down there. Another topic I kind of wanted to touch on is, before we get into this week's events, is something that I was just thinking about. You know, I was doing a radio spot during the Australian Open at the peak of the match-fixing talk with the report and various commentary press conferences held by the tennis establishment. And, you know, even the second week of the Australian Open, I was thinking, you know, the story broke on day one, and I got thinking that it seemed like it had already kind of fizzled out in a way. And then I don't know if that was a result of the nature of the tournament itself and the actual tennis, but, you know, really only a week removed from the tournament, from the Australian Open, and I wonder if really has this story already sort of fizzled into the background, and maybe more to the point, you know, is there any sort of standard that we can hold, or that the, you know, tennis itself can hold its organizations to, its integrity unit, to make sure that what was such a hot button issue is actually being looked at?
Well, I think we saw during the tournament sort of evolution among the authorities, especially the sort of guy who became the spokesman for it, Chris Kermode, the ATP chief. He started out saying, you know, we're fine, everything's fine, don't worry about it. But by the end, he had sort of conceded that there needed to be an investigation or a sort of overall look at what the sport was doing with its anti-corruption unit called the Tennis Integrity Unit, and also whether I think even more important how transparent the sport needed to be about what it was doing. So I think there was progress there. Since then, we found out that the person leading that that investigation has been involved in tennis, so he may or may not be completely independent. We'll see about that. I do think there was progress there. We also just found out today, you know, another reminder of it, that the Guardian had a piece about how there have been two low-level chair umpires were banned from the sport for being involved in illegal gambling, helping out gamblers online, and that wasn't revealed by the ITF.
Did you see some of the specifics of that? Was it just kind of feeding them information, quicker than normal, or how?
Yeah, they would text the score, in some cases, text the score to a gambler, to people doing online betting before they registered the score, so that you could bet on something that hadn't publicly been, people didn't know about what was going to happen. It was inside information, basically.
Right. Yeah.
But you know, I think tennis's problem is this idea that it needs to present itself as being pure, as being, you know, untainted by any of these problems that come up in other sports. I think anybody, there's a case where we try to hide too much. Tennis tries to hide too much, and I think anyone would admit or understand that there's corruption at tennis tournaments, or even at low-level tennis tournaments. There's going to be people involved with that kind of thing in any sport, but I feel like tennis is too worried about its image in upholding a pure image publicly, but it doesn't reveal enough of these things. You know, you can't reveal everything. You know, the match-fixing scandal in Australia, you couldn't just put out names of suspicious players. That you can't legally do that. But I think there's a balance that tennis could get better in what it does reveal.
Yeah, I think what you said about having someone who's worked within tennis and someone who's led the investigation, this to me has always been sort of, I think, something that has maybe held the sport back in some ways, is that it always, I think, has been very hesitant to embrace widespread change. And I think, you know, if you look back at recent CEOs, when you talk about, like, Etienne de Villiers came in, Larry Scott, these were leaders who did not have significant tennis backgrounds. And I think largely when their time with the sport was over, we're kind of really passed on in preference of someone who is kind of more of a blue blood in the game. And I think there's sort of a comfort in that with people who are, you know, within the industry. You look at it in terms of, many people have been calling for Fed Cup, Davis Cup to change, and I think it's more of a tradition base. That's one of the huge arguments with it. You see it with, look at all this has been, talked about many times, but, all the conflicts and perhaps that come with, the announcers that we hear about in the game. I think maybe, a point that we're kind of talking about in this whole thing is that it's really a big challenge for tennis to kind of move away from what it knows and what it's done for so long. And I think all sports, do that in their own particular way, but I think some sports maybe do it, handle it better than others. I've often said online, I often tweet this when I see something that I just shake my head about the game, is that tennis can't get out of its own way, and I feel like it does that in a couple of instances, and maybe this is another example of that.
Yeah, I think it's almost a niche sport, a small sport that doesn't understand or is only beginning to understand that it's also an international sport. That yes, it used to be this, it used to be all amateur, it used to be have a reputation for being pure, but now it's played all over the world. It's you know, it needs a different level of policing, a different level of sort of, you know, attention, or even just an admission that it's an international sport that there are bad elements involved in tennis, and it needs to police itself. You know, it hasn't given enough attention or money to policing itself.
Yeah, and the lower level stuff to me is interesting with this, because that's, you know, that has been a word that has been handcuffed to every discussion of the game, is that, you know, many people concede that, you know, in lower level, almost like as if it's okay, in that, you know, it goes on in this realm of the game, but, you know, in the section of the game that really defines tennis professionally, you know, we don't see that there. That's what I think a lot of the talk has been since this all came out. And actually, you know, I've noticed over the past couple of years that these lower level tournaments, these challengers in particular, they've been given a higher profile in terms of, especially online coverage. The ATP has I think they've sort of rebranded the Challenger Tour altogether. They have devoted a big part of their website to it. You can pretty much find those tournaments streaming without too much difficulty, and that's a balance that when we're talking about match fixing. Obviously, that stuff can play into the hands of potentially, you know, the wrong individuals here, but, you know, overall, it's giving the game still a more of a profile and more of a platform. So I think that's worth watching over the next couple of years, is how tennis especially handles this on that lower level, because I think you do need to if that is indeed the root of the problem, then that's where a lot of the focus needs to go to. So I'm curious to see what the steps are taken, you know, in that direction.
Yeah, I think the Tennis Integrity Unit had focused, you know, as far as it could up until now on making sure that kind of stuff was rooted out at a higher level, at a ATP level. But you have to, you know, these stories, the more they come out, people who just hear these stories don't necessarily differentiate between low level or ATP or Grand Slam events. It's just tennis. And, you know, tennis's reputation will suffer whatever level, you know, event these things happen at.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's quickly move on to this week. I do want to get to just kind of an overview of where things are on the calendar. A full week away from the Australian Open. Tournaments kind of all over the globe. This is, you know, typical of February. In particular of interest, you have Rafa playing in South America, as he's done over the past few years, to varying degrees of success. There's examples of last year he had Fanini beating him. He had Zabaios a couple of years back. Rafa's had some good results there as well. He comes back, and so maybe we'll just start with Rafa. I mean, I think clearly what he does after a first round loss in Australia has got to be, you know, the week's big story, no matter what happens.
Yeah, you know, he's back on clay. He this is where he typically either does well. A few years ago, he started a long run of success down in South America. He hasn't been able to repeat that, but he's had good events there. I think, in a way, it's almost in a way he can't. He can win in Buenos Aires, but there's more of a downside if he starts to lose at events like this, clay events, smaller clay events, regularly. Then you really start to feel like, where's his confidence going to go from there? What are other players they're going to become more confident. This isn't an easy tournament either. Ferrer is there, Tsonga is there, Fognini is there as well. You know, there are Verdasco's there. There are matches that
John Isner's there.
There are matches that Rafa could lose. So you almost feel like he's got to win this event, or he's got to do well, at least for the immediate future, for how he feels starting out this season.
Yeah, so, you know, we got that for to look at this week. And as I said, as we pointed out before this chat right here, John Isner eschewing the friendly confines at home of Memphis, where I pretty much the entire tournament otherwise is American-based. It's interesting not in the fact that, as you pointed out, that Donald Young is a three seed and Ryan Harrison gets a main draw, makes the cut alone on it. But this one's more interesting for the fact that we'll be seeing many of the very highly touted young Americans, teenagers that were just, you know, just coming off the junior Grand Slams last year. Taylor Fritz, Michael Moe, if you've been to the Open, you've probably seen quite a bit of them playing in various events, and they're on, I saw them actually quite a bit on courts 4, 5, 6 when they, you know, when the Open is redone, that section of Flushing Meadows. A lot of their matches were held on those courts. You get to see them up close, and they'll be playing at a, you know, an ATP level event this time.
Yeah, I think if you want to see American players right now, this is, you know, this is your tournament. 13 guys were in out of 28. We've already seen Ryan Harrison. He got a direct entry into a tournament that's fairly rare. He has a win already over Francis Tiafoe, another American. You'll see later tonight Taylor Fritz against Michael Moe, two teenagers, another young player, Tommy Paul, Donald Young. The second seed is Steve Johnson, an older player who's had, you know, had a really good year last year. So, you know, this is a chance for a showcase for U.S. tennis, guys you might not, you know, unfortunately might not see at the Grand Slams or at a lot of bigger events these days. So in that sense, it'll be an interesting week for U.S. fans to sort of get an idea of where these guys are right now.
Yeah, it's, like I said, kind of a mixed bag across the ATP and WTA. Really, there's sort of notable players of interest in almost any event. This week, you can read Steve's full preview rundown of them on tennis.com, and I suggest you do that, as well as with a nice look at Martin Hingis as well, really what has turned into really another career, as we were alluding to earlier. So, with that said, we will part ways and reconvene next Tuesday, as always, here on the Tennis.com podcast. This is Ed McGrogan for Steve Tigner. Thank you for listening.
You've been enjoying the Tennis.com podcast. For all the latest news and events, head over to Tennis.com.